Right, I think let's get cracking. Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for joining our latest Employment Law 101 session. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner at MPM Legal. We're a specialist business and immigration employment law firm. We are based in the south of England. We work with companies that are all over the world that have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. At this point, I would normally say I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague Adrienne. And for those of you that have joined us before, you'll see that it isn't actually Adrienne sat in the hot seat today. It's my former colleague, Sarah. I'm equally delighted to welcome Sarah to this session. So, good morning, Sarah.
Hello, and hello everyone.
And I think do you want to just give a little introduction to your background, Sarah?
Yeah, of course. So some of you who are on the call may know me. I've seen a few familiar names already. I was a partner at MPM Legal up until about just over 2 years ago. And I now have two jobs. But the one that's relevant for us today is that I run an inclusion and diversity business along with another familiar name, Mr. Mintz, and perhaps a not so familiar name, our third business partner, Rachel Edwards, with an intention to probably take a bit of the fluff out of DEI and focus on really data-driven, effective outcomes and results. So that's why I'm here today.
Yeah, brilliant. And I know, I mean, it's always great listening to your insights on DEI. So I'm really, really curious to know what you're going to be covering today. Just a couple of very quick housekeeping matters. We are recording this session, so you will be able to review it later or go onto our website. You can also check out our podcast on Spotify as well. You just need to search for Employment Law 101. If you would like to ask questions, I'm sure Sarah would love to field some questions today. Please just use the Q&A function down at the bottom. You can use a chat function if you want to chat to other participants, but for questions, just helps us manage them if you use the Q&A function if you're joining us live today. So, I think the seed for this session was probably formulated by a tweet from a certain individual who owns an electric car manufacturing company many months ago when he said words to the effect of DEI is another word for racism and shame on everyone who uses it. So, do you think DEI must die?
I mean, it's not a spoiler, is it, that I don't think that,
No.
given that I run a
Nothing.
business trying to help people do it effectively. But no, I think this notion that DEI must die is probably, so if we put aside for a moment the very obvious privilege that that particular individual has, that maybe means he hasn't really walked in the shoes of people who have a different experience in the workplace. I know, because it's one of the reasons why we set up MPM Included, that there is a level of frustration in some quarters about DEI initiatives or initiatives that are sort of all badged DEI that don't necessarily have a particularly positive effect. And I think you can call this what you like, right? I don't care if you call it DEI. There are so many acronyms for it. Call it a pineapple if you want to call it pineapple. What it actually comes down to is this is really about making workplaces fair. It's about having engaged employees. It's about attracting talent. It's about retaining talent. And also, it's about managing expectations, particularly if you're a business that is investor-led, or indeed in relation to your customer base. So I don't think DEI can die. You can call it something else. Let's not get caught up in the names. But actually, there is a requirement, and particularly in the UK, we've just had a change of government, in case anyone hasn't noticed. And there is a real focus on workplace fairness that ties in really, really nicely with this agenda. I do, however, have some sympathy for the position that, DEI doesn't work, et cetera, and we can come on to talk about that. But I understand perhaps where the sentiment comes from. As I said, two places. One I think is privilege, and one I think is frustration. But there's so much stuff, Peter, and there's so much stuff that's in your world that actually intersects with DEI. So we've got pay gap reporting that's been in the UK for 7 years now for companies with more than 250 people on a very binary gender basis. We've probably got ethnicity and disability pay gap reporting coming down the line. So that's something else that segues into DEI. Because what causes a gap, and actually one of the things that led me to start this business, was the fact that people wanted help with how they break down the barriers to inclusion that are causing pay gaps and are causing progression of some people and not others. Then you've got the fact that the FCA is really focused on DEI, but if you read the FCA consultation paper, they're very, very focused on data-driven DEI. So it's not about, oh God, let's give everyone some unconscious bias training and hope that does the trick. It's about having a really, really data-driven, considered, outcome-focused approach. So you want something tangible, you want something where people are accountable, and you really, really want data, and I'm going to use that word a lot probably today. If you're then thinking about things outside of the UK, because we might have some people on the call who, like me in my other job, because I'm also an in-house lawyer now for some of the week, you might have people who are dealing with things on a more international level, and even things that are still going to impact on UK companies that are part of an international group. So particularly in Europe, you've got the Pay Transparency Directive. It doesn't come into force until 2026, but it is coming. And if you're not prepared for it, you're going to have a nasty shock when it comes to the summer of 2026. It's not going to be your favourite summer. You've also got the ESG Directive. You've got the corporate social responsibility stuff that ties into that. So there is so much tangible legal work that also would be aided by a really, really solid DEI strategy. So if that's not enough to convince you, then I'm sorry, there's no hope. Good luck to you on your way. But from my perspective, no, DEI must not die.
I mean, I think the timing of this session couldn't be better in some respects, because you mentioned about legislative change here in the UK as well. And obviously we've got the Employment Rights Bill being published today, which a lot of employers are probably refreshing their browsers to read right now. But you mentioned about the widening of pay gap reporting mechanisms, and that's something that is being seriously looked at, isn't it? So there is change. What, in terms of this backlash itself, why do you think there has been this backlash recently?
I think it's about ineffective approaches, right? So I think, even though the notion of diversity and inclusion has been around for a really long time, like probably the majority of my career, which is a really long time, the approaches have tended, I think, sometimes to be quite ineffective. It's an emerging discipline, so it's not like the law. When I'm practicing law, there is a reference source that I can go to. I can go to legislation, I can go to case law, I can go to commentary. There is a clear structure and a framework. It's much, much harder to find that in this area because it is still developing all the time. So what that means is that companies don't really know where to start. They know they've got to do something about it. But firstly, it's kind of seen as like kind of HR's problem. Spoiler, it's not HR's problem, it's everyone's problem. But because it's kind of like it's kind of HR's problem, it's over here, it's seen as a nice to have. And so there isn't a great deal of investment in it. It's not dealt with like a proper business project. It's not evidence-based. So you have quite often, and not across the piece, that I know there are some people out there, and in fact, I know one of your clients who I used to work very closely with is doing some great stuff in this space. So there are people who are really doing this in a thoughtful way. But there are a lot of companies who don't have proper resource to deal with this. We've got challenges left, right and centre because of the global economic situation in terms of costs and headcount. Anything that's seen as nice to have gets slashed. So you have initiatives that are either not happening at all or they're going on in isolation. And you're thinking, okay, well, I don't really know what our problem is, but I know that someone said something about unconscious bias training. So let's do some of that. And then it doesn't work in isolation. And then people get frustrated and tired and they don't want to invest anymore in it, and CEOs are saying, well, show me the numbers, where are the numbers that show me the benefit to the business? And you can't, because you haven't done the work in the first place to measure your progress or measure where you are or work out what really needs to happen. It's the same thing with setting up ERGs. Everyone loves to set up an employee resource group, right? And again, these things have tremendous value in the right way and as part of a really well thought out strategy. But don't forget, ERGs initially were set up not with company backing, but by employees as a kind of employee activism. And what's happened is that companies have kind of gone, oh, ERG, right, we'll set up an ERG. And then again, they don't really give them any budget. They don't really know what their remit is. They don't really have a voice, but it's almost a way to kind of keep people quiet. And then when you're doing this stuff as part of a not very well thought out strategy, or actually just a few things in isolation to tick some boxes, nothing changes. And people get frustrated and people think that DEI doesn't work. And if you do it like that, of course it doesn't work. If I was approaching any business project and I just suddenly threw a pen up in the air and said, right, wherever it lands, we're going to start with that and we're going to do some training. Like, of course it wouldn't work. It's completely illogical. So obviously I have a view about how this should be done properly, which I think helps deal with the backlash. So I think you've got to start by really understanding what your areas of need are, and that is data driven. The way that we recommend to do that is through using an anonymous survey, because it helps with, I struggled with the word anonymous there. Let's just say that again, anonymous survey. The reason for that being anonymous is really tied up with the data protection legislation across Europe, across the world, in the UK as well. Globally, it is generally better to deal with what can be quite sensitive information. So in the UK, we'd refer to it as special category data or sensitive personal information, depending on which piece of legislation you're looking at. You really don't want to be gathering a load of data and keeping a load of data about that, because then you're going to find that you have a clash between DEI on the one hand and data privacy on the other. So you need to find out where your issues are, but you need to do it in a way that actually allows you to have that insight without gathering a load of personal data. I think once you've done that and you can see, right, okay, well, I can see, let's say we've got a particular issue with race and gender and disability, but actually we only want to focus on one. And if I look at my employee demographic, I can see that possibly gender is going to be the thing that's most impactful because it impacts most people. Then you start to really dive into measuring the problem in that space. So you look at where the barriers are, you look at all of your processes, you look at the employee life cycle, and you work out, okay, where are my pinch points? What's happening here? Why have we got an issue here? If you measure gender pay gap, you've probably got some indicators there already. If you don't, you might want to think about doing a bit of a gender pay gap calculation. Then once you've got all that data and you can start to see where the problems are, then you can start fixing them. And that's when you get a really effective DEI strategy starting to form, because you're looking at systemic problems and barriers. You're not trying to fix people. So I have no problem with a women's leadership course in the right place, but don't put it in as a way to fix your gender pay gap in isolation, because again, it won't work, because the likelihood is that the problem isn't with your women, it's with your systems and your processes. And then as you start to build traction, because you're not trying to boil the ocean and do everything at once, you can build traction in one area and then you can start to bring in other areas, because the things you learn will also apply, I'm quite sure, to other intersecting characteristics. And then suddenly you've got a snowball effect where people are seeing change. And because you've measured at the beginning, you can actually show tangible change. So when your CEO asks for numbers, you've got data that you can share to say, look, this is where we were, this is where we are, this is what we still need to do. And by the way, this is why we still need some budget, because trying to do this without money is completely ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. So I think there's been a backlash because people are doing things with the best of intention, but without the resources that they need or without a strategy. And I think that means that people get angry and give up.
Yeah, I mean, I think your description of that resonates actually, because, you know, this the sort of the times that we get involved as employment lawyers, and, you know, you sometimes get the impression that it's, can you just provide us with a quick policy that does this or a quick policy does that? And there isn't that whole strategic thought process that underpins it. And yeah, I mean, of course, we can give you an all singing, all dancing policy that deals with, let's say, flexible working and how you're going to process flexible working application and what the criteria are and all this stuff. But actually, it's more of a cultural thing, isn't it? I'm going to use a phrase which I think I first heard you say, actually, which is, this stuff's got to run through an organization like lettuce through a stick of rock.
Yeah, that's one of mine.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's not embedded enough, is it? And you know, what I'm hearing is this piecemeal approach, you're going to spend the money on it. You're going to spend some time on it dealing with the piecemeal aspects of your DEI strategy, but you're not actually going to then see any returns based on that. And then that gives you a challenging discussion when you're talking to a CEO or a board about how effective strategies are. Because I think ultimately, it sounds like you don't have a strategy, and that's what it all starts with. You talked about kind of measuring, going in, measuring, and looking at identifying the problem. And I suspect that there are organizations out there that think that their issue or their requirement is in one particular area, but actually, when you drill down into it, it's not that thing they're concerned about, and there's something else, right? So just talk us through this sort of measurement piece and how that works.
And I mean, you say some organizations, so far every organization that we've worked with, I would say, has in some areas a pretty astute idea of what they might need, but there is inevitably always something that they haven't foreseen, something that they're like, oh my God, I didn't know that was a thing, whether it's age or whether it's race or whatever it is. And I think it's really, really important. One of the first things I do when I go into a business is I say, look, you're going to have preconceived ideas of what your problems are. And some of them are probably going to be right, but I need you to let those go a little bit. And I need us to strip back and say, look, let's actually look at what the data is telling us. Let's look at what the people are telling us. And then we can go back in and have a look at it. And it's really, really, really important to do that because, again, if you're approaching any other business project, you wouldn't just stick a pin in it to choose what you focused your resources on. Nobody has infinite resources in business. So you wouldn't just go, here's all of our business areas, let's do that one. You would actually go, okay, well, what's the information telling us? What's the data telling us? I don't understand why people aren't doing that with DEI as well. It's just the best way to have an impact. It's the best way to reach the most people. And it's the best place to start because nobody's saying that you're going to be stuck on that one or two, those one or two areas forever. But you've got to start somewhere. And that's part of the problem is that this problem can feel so overwhelming unless you put some structure around it.
Yeah, okay. It's as you're talking then, I'm just thinking about analogies really, and it's a bit like starting a fitness regime or something, but not measuring where your baseline is, I suppose, not understanding the areas of weakness that need to be addressed.
100%.
What I mean, obviously, you're a massive advocate in taking a strategic approach. But what if you're on the company side? What are the benefits of taking this approach? What is it you can be saying if you're briefing internally about, hey, look, this is why we need to get on board with working in this in a focused way. What are the benefits that that can bring, rather than just kind of bumping along?
So I think you really need to think about your talent strategy. I think it's absolutely crucial to think about where you are getting talent from and the kind of talent that you want.
And so are you
And
talking there about external recruitment and also how you develop people?
both.
I know on this call, and I know listeners in terms of people that will listen to this in the future, we've got such a varied kind of audience in terms of business size. Some are going to be 10 to 15,000 employees. Some of you I know will have 10 to 15 employees. So are you talking about both of those aspects, external recruitment
Absolutely.
and internal
So
talent management as
if
well?
I break it down, I'm talking about talent attraction and
Okay.
I'm also talking about talent projection, projection, progression.
Progression, yeah.
So why I'm thinking about that in particular is we've got a multi-generational workforce now, right? And it is not right, and it would be remiss of me as someone who holds myself out as a professional in this space to make sweeping generalizations about people of different generations. But there is no doubt that there has been a cultural shift in terms of what talent is looking for that has shifted as more younger people have come into the workplace, right? And I think probably the real crux of that was probably people of your and my generation when we entered the workforce, so the cusp of Generation X and Millennials, right? Because suddenly the things that we were looking for, and also after the financial crash in 2008, the things that were available to us, it suddenly wasn't all about cash anymore. Whatever your personal sort of motivation, those things weren't necessarily available. And so people were looking for different things. And one of the things they were looking for was a company that treats people well, that has good fairness, takes an interest in people's well-being, accepts that people, might want some time and might not want to work 24/7. And that hasn't eased, that's continued.
Oh, you see,
So
like the development of B Corp as a thing, and companies that really say we think there's real value in being seen as, or, well, living and breathing it, but also having the recognition that we are a values-based company that wants to look after our employees, wants to have an ethical supply chain, wants to treat people in a fair way, and that definitely translates into employees' expectations now in terms of considerations for where they want to go and work and be associated with, right?
100%. So you've got B Corp. You've also got, again, coming back to stuff like, and again, European legislation, but it's going to have impacts here as well. Things like the ESG frameworks, the corporate social responsibility. So you've got people looking to see, and the thing is, this information is going to be increasingly out there. It's not something that you can squirrel away to yourselves anymore. People are looking on companies' websites to see, what do you do about DEI? What do you do? How do you make sure that you're treating people fairly? How is your workplace fair? Right? So it's about pulling in the talent that you want in the first place. And you know what? There's always going to be companies like the electric car company, like certain high-end financial companies that maybe think this isn't important. And there'll always be people who want to go to those companies. But for most companies, differentiating factors in terms of attracting talent are going to be, how do you treat your people? And DEI is inextricably wound up with that. Then you've got progression once you've got people in. How do you make sure that you get the best people for the job, not the people who all look the same as the people who are currently in management? Because that's often what happens. And that is where bias training can have an impact, is kind of waking people up to the fact that they will be hiring familiarity, right? Or they will be promoting familiarity because we all think we're brilliant at our jobs. And I can give you a really clear example of this. When I was in one of my in-house roles and I had to hire a team, I hired three young women from varying degrees of a slightly less privileged socioeconomic background. Does that sound like anyone you know? Like, we all do it. I did it, right? So there's this piece around, okay, well, let's have some guardrails in place to make sure that we're actually getting the best people for the job and we're progressing the best people for the job, which then builds the company. There's a fantastic book out there called Rebel Ideas, which I highly recommend. And that is all about diverse thinking, right? And you can say until you're blue in the face that if you have a group of people who are all completely homogenous in their background and characteristic, that they still think in a diverse way. I think that's a challenge, right?
Maybe
Like,
they think in a
fantastic if they
diverse way.
do. Yeah, because how do you get diverse thinking if you don't have different experiences? You and I have had loads of conversations over the years that we've worked together, both in the law firm and since, where, we both have a certain view of some stuff, socioeconomic stuff, for example, because of our respective backgrounds. But I might have a different view of something because I'm a mother, not a father, or because I'm a woman, not a man, and vice versa. And you bring that diversity in, and it creates this richness, and it creates opportunity, and it creates creativity. And there's actually all sorts of studies out there from great big organizations like McKinsey that show that it actually creates profit as well, like significant profit, if you can get that right. But it only works if you have diverse thinkers who also feel included and like they belong to something. So you can't just dump a load of people into a room, you can't hire a load of different people and then go, right, you might not feel very comfortable here, but knock yourselves out. Please create loads of profit for us. That's
Maybe
not going to
loads of
work.
money.
Other stuff that it can bring to a company, investors are interested in this. And again, increasingly, there is a requirement for this information to be out there publicly. Customers are interested, but also you might be able to enter untapped markets because of something that someone who has a different way of thinking about things is able to present as an idea that suddenly then pushes you into a really, untapped or relatively untested market that might be worth millions or billions of pounds. And yeah, I've already talked about that piece around creation, innovation, and profit. But please, 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 everyone who's on the call, don't lose sight of the fact that you can't just hire in for that. You've got to have a culture, you've got to have a sense of belonging. And that's not always easy, right? That takes work because the easiest thing is to have a totally homogenous team that doesn't need any of that because they all feel super comfortable with each other because they're all the same. But that isn't going to get you those benefits. Hard work brings benefits.
And in I know you've touched on, you mentioned the EU's corporate sustainability reporting and some of the emerging regulations, and we know that the Labour government are considering widening out pay gap reporting as well. So if you're a larger organisation, that's on the horizon. What about workforce diversity metrics and investment and things like that? What are you seeing there? What do we need to be thinking about?
I think, firstly, you need to be thinking quite hard if you're a company with European sort of group companies about whether you're going to fall within the criteria of the sustainability reporting directive or the ESG stuff in Europe. Same with pay transparency. You know, just think about that off a bit off to the side, but still think about that. I think you've got to understand that things that are actually called on the face of it, reporting or transparency, mean that there is going to be public information available. And that public information is going to drive deeper DEI engagement because you're going to have to be getting this stuff right to achieve the outcomes that you need to achieve to have the good figures, because you're going to have to report on them whether they're good or not, right? So you want to make them good. I also think you've got to think again about investor decisions. You're going to have tangible data out there, you know, and investors are going to demand data about what you're doing in this space. And you're not going to be attractive if you're not getting this right, is the simple truth.
It's like the carrot and the stick, really, isn't it? And you've got government regulation, you know, wielding the stick, but you've got the carrot of, you know, better profitability and all of the other good altruistic reasons for really, really investing in this. I'm mindful of the time. I know we are going to come in on time, I think, today, just about. It's fantastic. Just tell us your thoughts on the future of DEI. I mean, I would say it's had a battering this year, the concept of it, or certainly very prominent voices have been trying to attack it. And we've heard you speak about all the really, really good reasons about why we do value it and buy into it and see the inherent value there. What about the future there? Where, for you, what does the future hold for DEI?
I don't think it's going anywhere. I think that companies who get this right are going to thrive. I think that to get this right, you have to be logical, you have to be data driven, you have to look at processes and systems, you have to stop pretending that this is about individual people who need fixing and actually like accept the fact that maybe even if you have great policies, if you're not applying them in the right way, that maybe the problem is your company set up and not individuals of a particular demographic within your company. Stop treating it like a fluffy side project and start treating it like a properly funded business project, with input and accountability that goes all the way through from the CEO to the people who are out there making your widgets or driving around selling your product or whatever it is. And I think if you do that, then it's going to pay dividends. There are always going to be companies that don't do this. But the question for me is, are you confident enough in your product and in your brand and in your company that you can afford to be one of them? Because I think there's very, very few companies that actually have that much standing that they can afford to just ignore this stuff. And ultimately, what we're talking about here is workplace fairness. We're not talking about something magical. Like I said, if you don't like DEI, don't use DEI. I don't care. It doesn't matter what you call it. Just, I mean, like I said, pineapple's great as a code word. It does work. It works if you approach it properly. It works if you approach it with logic, with proper buy-in from your leaders, right from the CEO down. If they need help understanding it, that's fine, but you know, help them. It works if you have budget, and it works if you don't look on it as a little problem over there for HR to deal with that doesn't affect anyone else. And if you're saying DEI must die, then probably what you're actually saying, just to circle right back to where we started, and that very wealthy individual, is that for you, the status quo works. Well, that's great, but there's a heap of people in your company who it doesn't work for. And the question is whether you can afford to run your company without.
That's a good thought. That's a good thought to end on. It's a good thought to end on. Pleasure as always, Sarah. Always love hearing your thoughts. How can people who are listening, people who are joining us today, how can they hear more from you, get in touch with you, see more?
So
So included.
NPM Included has a LinkedIn page, and I also have my own LinkedIn page where I am regularly gobbing off about all sorts of things, including mainly DEI. You can also get me on sarah@npmincluded.co.uk. Please feel free to drop us a line if you're interested. We're really happy to chat to people. We don't have to have a hard sell. Even if you just want half an hour to chat to us and kind of say, well, I'm thinking about this, you know, it's in our interest. What we're ultimately looking for is the change. And yeah, we'd be delighted to help you with the change on a formal commercial basis. But if you want a half hour chat, just let's have a chat so we can maybe try and help you out with a couple of pointers. So yeah, don't be strangers.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, anyone listening, I of course, highly recommend Sarah's views on this. And you've just got, you know, so much valuable experience and expertise to tap into. So make use of it, people. We'd love to have you back on 101, Sarah. Obviously, you know, we've got a lot of legislative change. It kind of intersects with your areas of interest as well. So maybe we can get our heads together offline and we get another session booked in. Talking of future sessions, we're going to be back in 2 weeks' time. I'll be back with my regular co-host, Adrienne, I expect. I think really it's ripe in 2 weeks for talking about some of the employment Bill of Rights stuff that's come out today. But I think we'll probably look at the flexible working aspects of it, actually. So look out for an invite on that. Of course, I'm going to plug the podcast. I think we're up to 53 episodes now on Spotify. So there's something for everybody on there. Have a look, Employment Law 101. I think you can access it through Apple Music as well. Any follow-up questions, drop me a line at NPM Legal. Otherwise, thanks so much, everybody, for joining today. And we will see you in a couple of weeks' time. Enjoy the rest of your week.
Thanks, everyone.